Goddess of Yesterday, A Tale of Troy, Chapter 5. And so we landed in Gythion, where war stretched into the blue cauldron of a vast bay, and the slate roofs of storehouses and workshops were strewn for a mile. Upon the sand, seagoing craft of all sizes were beached. Men were blackening hulls with pitch, making rope for rigging, and carving oars. Women were sewing together the many patches of linen required to make a sail, for no loom can weave so wide a cloth. Shipbuilders were hewing beams. Open-fronted potteries held thousands of bowls in towering stacks. Immense enclosures of sheep and cattle, soon to be sold or slaughtered, filled the air with the rich scent of manure and hide. All these lay abandoned as the people sprang forward to welcome their king and tell him the good news that the plague was over. It was a day of terrible heat. The sun leaned down to burn the skin and blind the eye. Menelaus had been oiled by his slaves so his skin would gleam, for the face of a god shines, and a king is armed to the gods. On his red hair sat a helmet cut through with holy shapes. From his shoulders hung an ivory-hilted sword, useless in battle, breathtaking in parade. His cape was embroidered with hundreds of arrows flying in all directions, the back panel woven with stallions chasing the wind, while apple-green oceans lay under blood-red skies. Queen Helen had made it. The captain, Kynidas, told me. Men waiting on shore gave Menelaus the right hand of friendship and clasped his shoulder. Women knelt to embrace his knees. They all came, salt merchants and elegant ladies, little boys and sagging grandmothers, and potters with clay-stained hands. We waded through crowds as deep as the water we had just left. Every citizen needed to touch him or his garments. I knew the kings were holy, but I had not seen a people worship their king. How proud Helen must be of such a husband. How eager to see him after so long a separation. How excited his four children, who would soon embrace a father returned in honor. A king whose prayers end plague is held in the cup of the god's love. Gythion was unwalled. How strange to be inside a town and yet be able to look out. Gythion did not have the tight, huddled anxiety of Cephnus. It was noisy and relaxed. Its central square was not square at all, but just an openness, called an agora, with a stone floor and stone benches. Trellises gave shade, black poplars stood behind a splashing fountain, and red flowers bloomed in great clay jugs. The priests had already begun the roasting of the god's portion from the many sacrifices, and slaves carried forth the feast. There were fat, twisted loaves of bread and bowls of black olives and stiff, cool celery. There were casseroles of barley, cheese, and onions, into which people dipped fingers or bread. There were poppy seed cakes and honey cakes with currants. And there was shopping. On Cephnus, we traded. Villagers brought cheese from their sheep or yogurt from their goats. Fishermen came with their catch. Traders landed with wheat and rope and furniture. These were laid out on canvas or dropped on the sand. Now and then, a vendor might erect an awning to keep the sun off fresh berries. But Gythion had buildings for no purpose except the exchange of goods. These were arranged row upon row, their fronts open to the air, but their roofs permanent. Hundreds of people gawked and traded, arguing furiously about a fair exchange. There were perfumes and rouge, eye color and lip balm, rings of gold and anklets inlaid with carnelian, razors and combs, an ostrich egg, and the ivory tusks of some great creature, swords and daggers, double axes, and arrowheads. There were leeks and scallions, pomegranates and figs, and salt in great barrels, cassia to control the bowel, and hyssop to cure leprosy. There were mirrors and vases, idols and statues, painted tables, sturdy stools, feathered caps, and bronze scimitars, flutes of wood, and lyres of tortoise shell. There was a slave market. One doesn't normally give slaves a thought, but a very pretty pair of girls my own age were lifted up on the sale table. If Menelaus found out that I, whom he rescued, had stolen a birthright, Slavery would be the best I could expect. Being flung off a cliff like a newborn unworthy of its father was more likely. I was surrounded by slaves, fearful of who might purchase them and for what use. Fine, strong men in shackles awaited the field or salt mine. Young women nursed babies, which would be taken from them so the breasts could be used for the master's child. There were weavers for sale, potters and jewelers holding up examples of their accomplishments, that they might be judged worthy. I entered the nearest booth and examined vests and kilts made of thick leather for men who could not afford armor. These were an unlikely purchase for me, so I moved on. Sponges were available at many stands. One needs a sponge for hygiene. I picked them over. Behind me, the slave trader called out the final bid on the twins. "A princess," I said to myself, "does not notice slaves. I am Callisto of Cephnus. I do not give slaves a thought." In the next booth were dyes in copper vats, arsenic to make bright yellow, and madder for dark red. I thought of color. How many people knew that Callisto had had black hair, that Callisto had been crippled? From booth to booth, I walked in a daze, thinking of all that could go wrong, of all that was wrong with the whole undertaking. And yet, my goddess had agreed with me. I must hold on to that. In a jewelry booth, I found something I couldn't identify. It was a tiny jar, the length of my finger, and hardly twice as wide. I forgot everything as I held this amazing jar. I could see through it. The merchant dropped a shiny red bead into the jar, and I could still see the bead. It broke all the rules of a container. It contained, but it didn't hide. "What treasure have you found, my princess?" said Menelaus, smiling down. "A magic jar," I told him. "Not magic, but glass. It comes from Egypt. I have sailed there twice and met their king. They are a very strange people." "Glass?" I whispered, stroking the smooth surface of the magic jar. "Menelaus bought it for me." The merchant lowered my glass into a bag of soft kid skin and told me never to drop the glass or let it tip over, because it broke more easily than hearts. "She is too young to know about broken hearts," said Menelaus. I saw that he had not really been smiling at me. He was smiling at the world. He was home. His queen, beautiful Helen, would have ruled in his stead, as had Petra in Nicander's absence. She would have planned a storm of joy to welcome him back. I held tightly to my new treasure. And there was also the treasure of Nicander to consider. Did I now own everything Nicander owned? If so, I was a greater pirate than anyone on earth, for I had stolen an island. We were to spend the night in the house of a noble named Axon. The house of Axon was larger than the palace of Nicander, yet it was spare and unwelcoming. No tapestry brought warmth to the walls, and no clay pots spilled over with flowers. I saw no altar. I shivered to come and go from a dwelling where no god watched the threshold. After Menelaus and Axon exchanged greetings and gifts, I was brought forward. "This," said Menelaus, putting a hand on my head, "is the only surviving child of Nicander of Cephnus. Every ship and farmer, every sheep and slave she owned, is gone. Yet the pirates fled before reaching the treasury." "So her dowry includes an island and Nicander's treasure," said Axon thoughtfully. He seemed puzzled. "I was a great friend of your father, little princess," he said slowly. "Of course, he loved you so." I could think of nothing safe to say to Axon, but a silent girl is a good girl. I kept my eyes down. His toes were so long they lapped over the edges of his sandals like misplaced fingers. His hairy ankles bulged with blue veins. The torchlight made a cruel shadow of his pot belly. "Your grace, your father's name," said Axon. "Yet I know your father Nicander feared for your health. Children recovered from sickness. I, Callisto, could recover from being crippled." "My parents offered many prayers during my long illness," I said, "sacrificing often. The goddess healed me. Where I was weak, now I am strong." "How wonderful," said Axon. But he was still puzzled. He took a lock of my hair in his fingers. It was good he had not touched my hand, for my flesh had gone as cold as winter. I raised my face and smiled into the man's eyes. "My mother, the queen, often said that my hair is like rose petals," I told Axon. "She said red hair is an uncommon gift from the gods, and she often gave thanks." "And so do we all," said Axon, smiling and relaxed. "Who could not rejoice in such beauty? 12 is a gawky, skinny age. Only my hair was beautiful. I wondered what color Hermione's hair was, daughter of Golden Helen and Flaming Menelaus." The two slave women came with me to my room, and when it was time to wash, I gestured that they might also bathe, and we had a happy time of it, for cleanliness is joy to a woman. Afterward, we used fragrant oils on our skin. The women knelt to me, holding up their hands and beseeching in their own language. They hoped not to be sold in the market. I held them by the back of the neck, they in submission and I in ownership. In the morning, I thought, I will beg the king's permission to keep these two. Then I remembered that I was a princess. In the morning, I would inform Menelaus of my decision. Axon's courtyard was grim and cold in the hour before sunrise. I was wildly excited and also afraid, for I didn't know how far atop the mainland my goddess could come. I wanted to cling to my women's hands, and the real Callisto would have. But I wished to be a different Callisto, a stronger, more regal Callisto. So I didn't hold a slave's hand. I stood as straight as the oar of Nicander's grave. Menelaus drew me aside. He looked very stern. The half-light of dawn cast harsh shadows over his face. His eyes, sharp now, not gentle, examined me from hair to sandals. Then he took my right hand and studied my palm, tracing the lifeline. Axon had told the king his suspicions. Menelaus knew now that the Princess Callisto ought to be crippled and dark-haired. He who had so kindly brought me a magic jar would despise me. I was a cheat and a liar, to be sold on the table like the twins who had trembled before their buyers. "Little princess," said Menelaus, "Axon has offered to marry you. It is a good offer. He will fortify your father's island and resettle it. He will care for your inheritance and make it grow. Your sons will enter the world with a fine lineage." Even though I had spoken the word dowry to coax Menelaus to guard the treasure, and even though last night Axon had used the same word, 12-year-olds do not think of marriage. No doubt possession of an island helped my looks. No doubt I would appear beautiful to any man in need of treasure. But Axon was old. Older than Menelaus. He was fat and wrinkled, and his toes were too long. He did not even have an altar at his front door so the gods could come and go. But the danger was more profound. Marriage is a vow. Dared I, in the company of gods, take a vow in the name of Callisto? I, Anaxandra? It is an offense to the gods to throw away your lineage, since the gods chose it for you. I had offended and did not shrink from the offense. I had stolen a birthright and did not shrink from that either. But steal a marriage? Axon would want sons. He would believe those sons to carry the blood of Nicander. But they would not. "Axon tells me Nicander's daughter is 15, said Menelaus. I would not have guessed this. You are nearly as small as my Hermione, who is 9. Actually, I was shaped like a twig of a tree and probably looked precisely like Hermione. If I said I was 15, Menelaus would make the dowry arrangements immediately, and I would be Axon's wife by nightfall. But if I admitted to being 12, I would be unmasked. I am 15, but because of my lengthy illness, I said, I am behindhand, and have not yet become a woman. A potential husband would think twice when he learned that. Suppose his bride was barren. Suppose she could not give him sons. Of what use was such a woman, even with an island? I see, said the king. Axon and I will discuss it further. Meanwhile, you will come home with me and play with Hermione. We set off for Amaclay. I had been told that it was 2 days' walk to Amaclay, a thing I could not imagine, since the hike across Sifnos, at the very widest, took about 2 hours. Wouldn't it be quicker to sail? I asked. There is no water. We are leaving the sea behind. And with that impossible remark, Menelaus put me in the care of the 2 serving women, and all 3 of us in the care of a male slave named Tenedos. Tenedos led us through the alleys of Githian and north of the town. We never passed through a gate, and we never saw a wall. If I were attacking Menelaus, I thought, I would sail quietly up the far coast and seize all the tiny villages in every tiny inlet, and then I would approach Githian from behind and take it by land instead of by sea. But these were the thoughts of a pirate, not a princess. I had to think of other things. And then I laughed out loud, for there indeed were other things. The Trojan horses. Their great rippling flanks gleamed where grooms had brushed them. Into their long tossing manes had been tied ribbons, and on their traces were medallions glittering in the first rays of sun. One matched pair was black as starless night. Another pair was sable, and several were white. The horses were very nervous, and people stayed well back when one stallion reared and snorted. He was dark, creamy gold, like topaz. A strike from his great hoof could break your leg. His groom spoke tenderly to him. Good boy, Seabelt, crooned the groom, and slowly the horse calmed, although it continued to mutter under its breath. The eldest son of Troy's king Priam, Hector, was famous as a tamer of horses. I had not understood how a man could achieve fame for putting reins on a horse. Now I knew. I edged closer. The groom smiled at me. You like horses? I love horses, I told him. He put an apple core in my hand. The topaz horse whickered softly and lowered its great head into my palm to take the treat. Then the stallion nodded its head up and down, as if saying thanks. Trojans speak Greek, said the groom, although with strange accents. But it means I can use the same names for these horses that their trainers used. This is Seabelt. The black pair with stars between their eyes are Sea Star and Sea Reach. I had a pumpy once named Seaweed, I told him. Isn't that interesting? I ran into a captain last year whose ship dog was named Seaweed. My heart was sudden. Should I ask for the name of the captain? The age of his dog, Seaweed? The names of the captain's sons and daughter? The topaz horse nibbled the grass at my feet, and I pressed my face into its long, wind-blown mane. Tenedos said, Little princess, you must stay behind me. Take my hand, please. I turned my back on the groom, who had perhaps listened to the bark of my puppy Seaweed, and shared a cup with my father, Chrysaor. I put them out of my mind, for the mind must be the mind of Callisto. Behind the Trojan horses were carts filled with Trojan gifts and Sifnu's treasure, my dowry. On my birth island, there had been 1 or 2 carts. Their wheels were always breaking from jousting over stones, so everyone preferred donkeys. On Sifnus, there had been several carts whose proud owners painted them in vivid colors, but wheels remained a problem, for the punishment taken by wheels quickly destroys them. These carts are different. Some had not 2 wheels, but 4. Some were pulled not by 1 mule, but by a pair of oxen. One immense wagon had 4 oxen. The wheels of this cart were bound in bronze. It kept the wheels alive longer, Tenedos explained. For this journey, the king himself would stand up in a chariot until he had left the crowds behind, while Axon and the other Githian nobles walked alongside, spilling wine to keep the feet of the king safe on his journey. The path was so wide that 2 carts could pass each other, and it was not simply made of beaten dirt, but spread with gravel. What a remarkable path, I said to Tenedos. It's called a road. The gravel makes the way smooth for wheels. When it rains upon such a road, there are no ruts and no mud. And when we reach the king's palace, the road will be paved. What does that mean? Slabs of stone, said Tenedos, as if the palace courtyard extended out beyond the walls, all the way down the citadel ramp, and far into the valley. The king must have many men, if they can be spared, to lift stones into place for a cart track. Menelaus' kingdom is far flung, said Tenedos, in a tired voice. Perhaps he had once thought himself safe from the far-flung power of Menelaus. Perhaps he had once been free. There are about 3,000 people in Amyclae, Tenedos told me, and Menelaus owns a dozen such cities. My jaw dropped at the thought of so many people on earth, and had not Menelaus himself told me that his brother Agamemnon had an even bigger kingdom? And had not everybody said Troy was the largest of all? How many people lived and breathed in this world? In his palace of Amyclae alone, Tenedos went on, are 500 female slaves and about that many slave children. He himself must have been a child when captured, for if he had been an adult, he would have been killed. When we had left the city behind, the king stepped out of his chariot. His men removed the wheels, folded up the basket, and set it on top of the 4 oxen wagon, and the king walked, as we all did. A white mule with exceptionally long ears walked placidly near him, in case he should wish to ride. But I knew that he would not. I have heard that in some parts of the world, people do not use their legs. I would not want to abandon my body like that, and a king among his troops would never do so. A slave named Pyrrhus jogged back and forth along the line, making sure every cart rolled smoothly, every slave walked swiftly, and every order was obeyed. Pyrrhus means fire, but in the overseer's case, it was not the comforting fire of the hearth. The slaves were afraid of Pyrrhus, and it infected me. When Pyrrhus whipped a laggard on both cheeks with a leather-bound rod, my fingers tightened convulsively on Tenedos's hand. It's all right, princess, said Tenedos softly. The overseer will not scold you. Isn't your name, Tenedos, the name of an island? Yes, lady. Tenedos is the island of my birth. It is not far from Troy, but we were never Trojan allies. We thought ourselves neutral and a friend to all. We were wrong. When Tenedos was sacked, we younger boys were taken as slaves, but none of us were permitted to keep our names, as it was too much trouble. We are all just called Tenedos. I knew what it was like to be sacked. I knew the number of bodies left unburied and the sobs of women in the boats. When was this? I asked, wondering how old he was, how slaves last better than field slaves. When I was 10, which Pyrrhus thrashed Tenedos on the back of the neck, where the spine ends, and hit him a second time on the side of his head, just above the ear. Tenedos staggered slightly. Do not bother a princess with your past, snapped Pyrrhus. You are nothing. Your past does not matter. Tenedos apologized to me. I spoke as a princess would. I will decide whether a slave requires punishment, I said sharply to Pyrrhus. But perhaps a princess would not say that, because she would not notice how a slave was treated. I had much to consider. Without warning, and although it was midday, we entered a shocking darkness. It was black, yet green, filling the world from earth to sky. It was the dark of trees, and yet not of trees. It was evil. What is this? I whispered. I wound my fingers around each other to keep them from grabbing the hand of Tenedos yet again. It is called a forest, my princess. Many trees in one place, so dense they blot out the sky, like the evil message of an eclipse. I too hate the forest. On my island, like yours, few trees stand together. We will walk for an hour among these pines before the forest ends. Nicander's bard used to sing a poem. 7 ways of terror in a forest all of pine. The empty. Now I understood the words. Do not leave the path, said Tenedos, as if I had considered this for one moment. The leaves that brush your face are the souls of those who died unburied. But Pyrrhus heard this and hit him again. Don't talk nonsense, slave.
Princess, the trees are just firewood. One day men will cut it all down. Anyway, we are armed.
Neither man nor beast will hurt you.
Tenetus and I were not worried about man or beast. When the overseer moved on, Tenetus hissed to scare away any spirits.
May the daemon of this grove take Pyrrhus and...
With an effort, Tenetus stopped himself from cursing in my presence.
I was sorry, because a good collection of curses is a useful thing, and Tenetus probably knew some I had yet heard.
I almost told Tenetus that I agreed with him. Pyrrhus was just a dog tick, but remembered in time that I was the Princess Callisto. At last, we broke out of the evil shade. Before us lay tilted fields sliced apart by dark hollows and rocky gorges. The Sparta before us was an unquiet land, skeletal, spines of rock and ribs of stone. White and black and brown sheep wandered, too many to count even with the word thousand. Flocks of wild doves burst out of bushes. Before us were mountains so high they invaded the god's sky. So this was the mainland. How could the people of Menelaus bear to live under these great mountains, close to the dark of that awful forest? But they did not live close, I discovered, for we walked on and on.
We passed fields of flocks being harvested with scythes. I had never seen this, and I found the rhythm and the gleam of the curved blades quite beautiful. Having set in motion my new life, could I keep it swinging back and forth? Like a scythe? Or like a scythe, would it cut my throat?
We came upon slaves knee-deep in pools of water, treading on the flax to soften the stalks so the linen thread could be removed. It was strange water, having motion but not waves.
The Eurotas River, Tenetus told me. It runs even in the heat of the summer.
I had never seen a river, only seasonal brooks from the spring rains. And in all my life, I had heard of only one river, the river at Troy, the great Hellespont. Since his birth island was so close to Troy, Tenetus must have seen that.
Is this what the Hellespont is like? I asked him eagerly.
He nearly laughed out loud.
No. Up this little stream, one man could pole a boat. In the Hellespont, 40 rowers could row till their hearts burst and hardly make progress against the current. We passed through fields of clover and red wheat, olive orchards frothing silver leaves like the foamy sea, and clusters of tiny stone houses. At the doorstep of a cottage, an old woman milking her goat let me drink out of the pail. It was warm and thick.
This mainland, I said to Tenetus, is a wondrous place. I didn't know there were mountains as high as gods. I never dreamed of roads or roads made of stone. You know, the first time I saw stairs, I chopped off my statement. It was Anaxandra who could remember the first time she saw stairs. Callisto had been born into a house with stairs.
Tell me about the family of King Menelaus, I ordered him.
Tenetus broke off high, slender grass and chewed the end of it. The household is confusing. Menelaus married Helen, a daughter of the king of Sparta. From this marriage, Menelaus' land greatly increased. All you see within the embrace of those distant mountain ranges and all the way back behind us, to the sea, is the kingdom of Menelaus. Helen also has twin brothers, much older than she, named Castor and Pollux, who also possess much land.
I know about Castor and Pollux, I said delightedly. They sailed with Jason on the Argo to bring back the Golden Fleece.
Every bard who ever visited Cephnos sang of Jason's voyage.
You will hear them sing even more now, said Tenetus dryly.
Castor and Pollux never tire of hearing how wonderful they are. The twins have even coaxed the astronomers at the palace to name stars in their honor. A princess should not let a slave speak badly of his betters. I should have Pyrrhus use his whip, but I wanted Tenetus silent about my stair mistake, so I let it pass. I said, I have never heard of the naming of stars.
He stared at me. But how do you study them as they cross in the night?
When I had no answer to this, Tenetus chewed down hard on his grass and said, Queen Helen has a sister, Clytemnestra, and Clytemnestra married the older brother of Menelaus, who is Agamemnon, strongest king in the world. So two sisters married two brothers. Agamemnon's far-flung lands are beyond those mountains on the north. When the brothers visit each other, they do not cross the mountain range, for the pass is fit only for wild goats. Each king returns to the sea and sails to his brother's port. I drew a picture in my head of marriage lines between the brothers. I drew lines down for the children of each king. With a sickening thud in my heart, I realized that I had paid little attention to the genealogy of Callisto. No noble child exists who cannot preach the family genealogy. I would be expected to recite it back 10 generations. I began piecing together the lineage. I knew the parents and grandparents of both Petra and Nicander. Could I recall anything more than that? The sisters Helen and Clytemnestra are the most beautiful women in the world, said Tenedos. Helen is so lovely that goddesses are jealous. But even the jealousy of a goddess cannot hurt Helen. In fact, nothing can hurt Helen, for she does not have an earthly father. She is the daughter of the Lord God Zeus. I had known this, of course. All the world knew. But now I would meet her. Was Helen fully human, or would I be able to tell that she was half god? Was her blood red like mine? Would she know things the way immortal gods did? Would she know, for example, that I was not Callisto? What does Zeus look like? I asked. Did Helen's earthly mother tell anybody? Was he a giant with huge muscles and a curly beard? Tenedos shook his head. Zeus came to Helen's mother in the form of a swan. Oh. I was blank. What is a swan? Tenedos sucked in his breath and held it. In his silence, I heard 1,000 noises. The creak of wheels and axles, the panting and wheezing of donkeys and mules, the clomping feet of oxen and horses, the slap of sandals, the talk and laughter of men. Little princess, said the slave softly, the court of Menelaus and Helen is sophisticated, and you have been isolated. You have never seen glass, don't know what a river is, and have never walked on a road, do not know the names of stars, have never seen a swan. Here is my advice to you. Stay silent. Be fearful of Helen. The daughter of a god pays no price for any action she takes. She cannot suffer, so does not discern the suffering of others. How dare a slave speak like that of his queen? I was angry with him. Listen carefully, said my goddess. You enter a strange world under a false name. He is an ally. Be thankful. Pyrrhus missed nothing. He was beside us in an instant, eager to inflict pain. The slave has offended you? He asked me eagerly, flourishing his whip. I thought I knew how he came by his name, Fire. He burned to hurt Tenedos. And then I saw sailing on the Eurotas River several large and beautiful birds whose slender heads turned on remarkably long, thin, white necks to study me. In the river, I said, what are those? Pyrrhus turned but saw nothing worthy of comment. Those are swans, princess, said Tenedos. In such a shape had Zeus visited the mother of Helen. How white Helen's skin must be, how long and slender her throat, how graceful her profile. We walked on. I dreamed of swans and cold, clear gods. Swans are vicious, said Tenedos. Be careful of swans, my princess.